And now we jump into our conversation about what is happening with Hurricane Sandy and its aftermath. We are joined by Amara Jones, economic justice contributor for ColorLines.com, who served in the Clinton White House, where he worked in international trade policy. And we'll be joined later by Mike Tidwell and Daphne Weisham to look at the potential effects of this storm in terms of climate change, and look at that. But Amara, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good morning.
So a very intense piece you wrote here.
On
what the aftermath of Superstorm Sandy meant for communities in New York. It's amazing to me, after a year, so much has been left undone.
That's right. I mean, but in a way, it's not surprising because, we have a mayor who, by his own admission, has seen as one of his key goals of attracting to New York as many billionaires in the world. And so as a result, has changed the focus of the city. And given the fact that the storm disproportionately impacted the working poor, disproportionately impacted people of color, that's just not where the city is oriented right now. So with that lens, it's actually not that surprising that so little has been done in the recovery of average people. And one of the things that was interesting to me was to see that the majority of those who've applied for FEMA assistance in New York are renters, and their median income is $18,000. And so that gives you a sense of who was impacted by the storm and the work that has to be done in order to try to get things back on track.
But what's amazing to me are the things that have just not been done from the piece that you wrote, that all the money, the billions of dollars put in, mm-hmm. how little of it actually has hit the ground. Whether you are working middle class in Queens or poor people who have been, as you wrote, talk about Bob Moses' minutes, I think this is important, were kind of shoved to the fringes of New York City, and what's happened to them.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. So out of the $500 million of community block grants that have funneled from the federal government to the state, to the city, and you know what a process that is, only one of those grants has been made. And those are directed at low to moderate income homeowners or renters or businesses. Only one has been made to a person on Staten Island. The fact that out of the 23 temporary boilers that were put at the New York City public housing units that were impacted by the storm. And mind you, 20%, one out of every five public housing units in the entire city is located in the flood zone. Not one of those temporary boilers has been replaced or repaired to be permanent enough. And we're on the cusp of winter. That's 10,000 people whose heat is at risk. A lot of those buildings still have problems with mold. A lot of those problems still have buildings have power outages. And the same is true in New Jersey. And so the Star Ledger had to take Governor Chris Christie, who's up for re-election, to task by saying that, and these are their quotes, that he has a, quote, persistent blind spot when it comes to the working poor. And most of those are Black and Latino in New Jersey. And even more recently, the Bloomberg administration is suing, this just occurred in the last 4 weeks, is suing to kick out hundreds of working poor Sandy victims from New York City hotels who still don't have a permanent housing solution because they say it's been a year and that those people need to find something else. But the problem is that homelessness in New York is at an all-time high, and we've lost 400,000 affordable housing units given to the policies that I spoke about before. So there's literally no place for them to go, particularly when the aid that's supposed to help them is basically non-existent, given what I said before. So it's a grim picture. And a lot of the city's efforts have been, quote, about resiliency. So for instance, in Lower Manhattan, all of Lower Manhattan has been rewired to fiber optic cable to withstand another flood so that they can still have telephone and power down there. The power stations in Lower Manhattan have been hardened and built up to withstand a storm on the scale of Sandy. And so a lot of the effort and the energy has been in the wealthier business districts of the area when the parts of the city that are where people are and are those that are most impacted still languish.
So I'm curious, Amara, why you think this is going on. I mean, here we see – I've seen people on some of the MSNBC programs on Melissa Harris-Perry's show and others who have talked about the middle class folks saying we have not gotten our money yet. They're still sticking us. We can't get there. Rents are saying in those same neighborhoods they're being moved out because the way they rehab the houses, they can't afford the rent anymore, which is typical of trying to move wealthy people into seaside areas. You're only doing lower Manhattan where the finance industry is and wealthy people live, but all the working people in the flooded out areas and the other parts of New York City have not been helped by Bloomberg and the administration. But what's the analysis of what's happening here? Why is this taking place this way?
We have a mayor and an administration who that's just not where their focus or their energy lies. I mean, I really think that that's it. And it's a simple answer. It's a disturbing answer. And it would be great if it were more complex, but it really is that simple. I mean, the day after the storm, this morning, actually, Bloomberg came out and declared New York City open for business. The day after the storm, they were still rescuing thousands of people who were waterlogged. There were people who were fighting for their lives. The New York Fire Department and the New York City Police Department were overburdened with search and rescue missions, as well as the Coast Guard that morning. But Bloomberg came out and said that New York City was open for business, and the next day the stock market would be open. And it was. The stock market opened 2 days later, even though Manhattan, that part of Manhattan, was dark and there was no power, no nothing. Wall Street was lit up like a beacon in a sea of darkness. And the day after that, they declared New York City back to work. So the day after Wall Street, they ordered everyone back to work, but realized, one, that commutes were so long because the transportation and that sort of thing didn't function. And secondly, a lot of the managers who live in Manhattan got to work and realized that they didn't have any workers and they didn't have any customers, because that's because where people were still affected and impacted to the point where those things didn't exist. And I think that it's just the orientation. It literally comes down to the fact that we have a mayor that this is just not his orientation. It's not what he necessarily is, where his energy or his passion lies. And so these things languish. Because, for example, the New York City Public Housing Authority is totally under his writ. That is something that they can fix. He said that things are moving too slowly there, that it's a critical problem. But in a year, that hasn't changed.
And but before we move on, this is descended directly in many ways from what the person that people laud as one of the greatest designers of New York in history, Robert Moses, who was a public works czar in New York for so long, where he pushed poor people to the fringes, as you wrote about, of New York City, which is where they were deeply affected by the onslaught of Superstorm Sandy. And those are the people being completely ignored in the process of rehabilitation.
That's right. I mean, one of the things that occurred in the 1960s was that there was a massive development of public housing in New York. And a large portion of that, one out of five units, 20% of the units, were located in these flood-prone areas that are far from the city core and more vulnerable as property and as land masses. And so we ended up concentrating large numbers of the most vulnerable in places that were the most vulnerable to environmental degradation and to storms. And you put those two things together and you have a toxic mix. You have what we had last year, which were, unfortunately, seniors dying in their apartments because there wasn't power, there wasn't heat, there wasn't a way for people to get to them. And so, you know, almost 90 seniors passed away due to that. And most of them were in public housing.
So one final thing in this, because when you have hundreds of residents who have no money, no nothing, who are really poor, who are being pushed out of their hotels by Bloomberg and his administration right now, some of them suing, as you wrote about, fighting back. Do you see the possibility of any change in any of this if and when, we probably will see when, Bill de Blasio becomes mayor of New York City?
I think so. I mean, one of the things that he said was that he was going to redirect the aid to have what he called a new beginning. And he made a campaign stop out into one of these areas that we're talking about, the Rockaways, where there's a large concentration of public housing, and made a pledge there that he was going to revamp the program. And I think that I was thinking about this morning, and it's been striking to me how little of the coverage has focused on some of the issues that we're talking about this morning. A lot of the coverage is about resiliency or we're coming back, and not necessarily the things that aren't done. But the interesting thing is that I do think that in the back of New Yorkers' mind, this sort of thing does play out. And it's one of the reasons probably why Bill de Blasio has a 40-point lead over Joe LaHoda, who was deemed as a hero of Sandy for getting the New York City subway back up and running so soon afterwards. Because I think people really do understand that these issues of class and race and economics and the way that they're playing out have life and death consequences, and that there may need to be a change in the way that that is going, and which is why it looks as if he's on track for a blowout next week.
Imara Jones, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Economic justice contributor for ColorLines.com, served in the Clinton White House, commentator on life and politics in America. Imara, great to have you with us once again.
Thank you so much, and thank you so much for doing this in the way that you did it. It's really important.
Thank you. Take care. Talk soon. Bye-bye. We're now going to switch gears and continue our conversation about Hurricane Sandy. We're talking with Mike Tidwell, who joins as founder and director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, and Daphne Weisham, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where she directs their Sustainable Energy and Economy Network and the Genuine Progress Project. And Daphne and Mike, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
Folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. We'll get to your thoughts. We'll look on Facebook here in just a minute to see what you've written, 410-319-8888. So I think most of us, at least on this program and when we talk about what's facing our nation and our earth, agree that climate change is a major issue, that an issue facing the future of mankind and who we are. But let me begin with you, Daphne, and go to Mike. But there's been a lot of debate I've been reading over whether climate change really had the major effect on what happened with Hurricane Sandy. How do you look at this and the weather events we're seeing? Then we'll go to Daphne and then we'll go to Mike.
Well, I mean, I think what we know for sure is that storms are getting more intense. Hurricanes are getting more intense. In the case of hurricanes there, the storms are less frequent, but the intensity and damage associated with each storm is increasing. We also know just for a fact that Maryland is going to see at least 3 feet of sea level rise by the end of the century. So,
3 feet.
3 feet. 3.5 feet by the end of the century, roughly 13 inches or so by 2050. So Baltimore, in particular, is highly vulnerable to many natural hazards, ranging from coastal storms and flooding. We will also see an increase up to 13 degrees Fahrenheit, which will mean Baltimore will be more like the climate of New Orleans by 2100. An increase of I'm sorry, did I say 13? I meant 12 degrees Fahrenheit in Baltimore alone. So we're going to see some major changes in weather over the next few decades.
And Mike Tidwell, I'd like to jump in on this as well. I mean, you've been talking a lot about this, and I'm going to read a couple of quotes from folks from NOAA who challenged some of the climate change stuff, but I'd like to hear your both comments on that. But your analysis, Mike.
Well, there is no question, 100% certainty that climate change played a major role in the destruction of Sandy. Now, you'll hear scientists will appropriately say, and, certainly climate deniers will scream that you can't tie any one weather event to a change in climate, and that's true. But systematic, or systemic causation is what we're talking about here. We have raised the oceans worldwide, including in the Atlantic, by at least a foot and a half in the last 100 years due to climate change. We have brought the oceans already closer to the people and the cities. And it's sort of like a basketball court. If you raise the floor of a basketball court by a foot and a half, it's a lot easier to hit a slam dunk. You can dunk the ball. Sandy was a slam dunk because we raised the floor of the basketball court. We brought the ocean closer to New Jersey, closer to New York City. So when that surge tide came in, she was already much higher than she would have been otherwise, this hurricane, and it caused the kind of destruction that we saw. The storm itself was also the biggest, the largest wind field, 1,000-mile-wide diameter wind field that had ever been seen in the Atlantic Basin. Scientists tell us that the biggest, most powerful hurricanes are coming more frequently with a warmer ocean linked to a warming atmosphere. So you have a bigger storm, you have the basketball court floor raised and sea level rise, and so systemic causation, absolutely. Climate change contributed directly to Sandy.
So I, this is, you know, when I hear things on my Facebook page that people write me and we go back and forth with different tweets, people are confused about this. They're confused about it because of the reports that you that take place. Like, I'm going to read you a couple of things here in a moment that that came out of one of the Washington Post weather reporters, climate reporters, Jason Samenow. And the way things are posited can be really, really confusing and conflicting for people to understand. I think we're about to take a break now. So, we have a couple of minutes before a break. I'll read them and then set this up. So when we come back, we take a few minutes kind of talking about this. I mean, you have people like Martin Herling, who is quoted in this article, who works for the National Ocean Atmospheric Agency, NOAA. And he said, talking about Sandy, in this case, the immediate cause is most likely little more than the coincidental alignment of a tropical storm with an extratropical storm. Both frequent West Atlantic in October. Nothing unusual with that. On rare occasions, their timing is such as a result in an interaction which can lead to an extreme event. And they talk about these events since 1890 have occurred up and down the Northeast coast because of that kind of alignment. But then you have, in the same article, a headline saying that crystal clear, climate change raised the oceans, temperatures and height, and worsened Sandy's coastal flooding, saying well-established that warm ocean water, all other things being equal, energizes hurricanes. The warmer the water, the more intense hurricane can become with stronger winds and heavier rain. So people who do not want to deny climate change but write in major media, we lay these things out trying to be balanced. In the end, they become very confusing for people to parse out reality. So, I mean, we're going to take a very brief break and come back. And I'd like, Mike and Daphne, if you could wrestle with that with our listeners for a moment to kind of parse some of this stuff out. We're going to go to break with Tony Bennett, Cold, Cold Heart. Because why? This is the day that song hit number one and made him the king he is. We'll be right back.
I tried so hard, my dear, to show that she's my every dream. Yet she's afraid each thing I do is just some evil scheme. A memory from her lone.
One pill makes you larger, and one pill makes you small, and the one...
Grace Slick, White Rabbit. She was born on this day, so we play a little bit of her classic sound as well. We are here with Daphne Weisham, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where she directs their Sustainable Energy and Economy Network and the Genuine Progress Project, and Mike Tidwell, founder and director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. So Daphne and Mike, let's come back to what I was saying. I mean, when people read these kind of things in what we call the balanced establishment press, I think people get confused because it makes it seem as if, well, it might be a little bit of climate change, but it's also natural weather patterns. So, and then you see the other kind of articles about polls saying that people worrying about climate change in terms of key phrases has gone down since Sandy because it's only event driven. So, Daphne, how do you respond to the world around this?
Well, I mean, I think it's analogous to tobacco and smoking. You know, there was cancer long before people were smoking cigarettes, but we also know that smoking causes cancer. And so what did we do in response to the tobacco industry pushing cigarettes on all of us? We made cigarettes more expensive because we understand that we all pay the price for cancer care. Now, fossil fuels, of course, we know that they increase the CO2 in the Earth's atmosphere. There were intense storms long before we began burning this much fossil fuels, but we also know that we're going to increase the number of intense storms simultaneous with rising the sea level. So we're just increasing the odds of these kinds of storms. And so, you know, I don't quite understand why it's so confusing for people. I mean, I suppose if you just look at one article in isolation and don't look at the longer-term trend, you might be confused. But I think there's some willful ignorance out there.
Willful, you said?
I believe so.
What do you mean by willful?
I think it's frightening to think through just exactly how serious this crisis is. I mean, we're talking about a 12-degree Fahrenheit increase in temperatures by 2100 for Baltimore. What does that mean for people? What does that mean for the city? What does that mean for the infrastructure? What does that mean for the priorities that the city needs to now address? Now, in the case of Baltimore, you actually do have a city that has imposed a climate action plan, that does have a disaster preparedness plan that they are now putting in place. We're working with them and the Baltimore Sustainability Commission. However, they're getting a lot of pushback from folks who say this is too expensive. We don't have the money. Mm-hmm. We can't afford to invest in this kind of thing at a time when the city is facing bankruptcy. And the fact is that our consequences of poor planning and not making these investments now will become much more serious as sea levels rise by a foot by 2050 and temperatures increase. And the benefits of taking action are have enormous consequences for people. One last thing I just want to say, you know, as sea level rises, another thing that people aren't considering is that the Eastern Shore Aquifer will more or less disappear with the first meter, with the first 3 feet of sea level rise due to saltwater intrusion. So this has consequences beyond just, you know, it has consequences for our water supply, it has consequences for our infrastructure, and I do think that there is some willful ignorance because the problem does seem so big.
Mike?
Well, if you look at the polling data, you see that people who identify as Democratic or identify as usually voting Democratic overwhelmingly accept the science of climate change, the facts, the data, the evidence of climate change. The percentages are, you know, in the 70-80% high among Democrats. When you look at Republicans, the acceptance of the science of climate change is very low. It's as low as, you know, in the 20s. Why is that? Well, because many Republicans get their news from the conservative media echo chamber. We all know about that, Fox News and the rest. Polls, you know, survey data shows that people who get most of their news from Fox are misinformed and are less, you know, are more ignorant of major issues. Like, did Saddam Hussein play a role in 9/11? He did not. That's been proven over and over again. Republicans overwhelmingly believe he did because they get their news from Fox. Same with climate change. They get their news from Fox that there's a debate, that it's uncertain, that the planet is actually cooling, and all the rest.
Mm-hmm.
So it's understandable that people are confused, but it breaks down along political lines. I would emphasize that. You're starting, however, to see even people in Republican districts, even in people in rural conservative areas, are actually living, seeing, being impacted by climate change, retreating from coastlines, and finally realizing that, you know, something is happening, and more you see those people on the front lines, conservative, liberal, in between, embracing the science and ready to do something about it.
And before we move on and meet again the family of Tyrone West, who died at the hands of the police and is still standing up to fight for his legacy and for other men and women in the city, we're going to call her in here. So I think this as we transition out, 410-319-8888 is the number here. And we're talking to Russ. Russ in Baltimore, you're on the air. Welcome.
Greetings, Mark, to you and your guests. Mark, I'll be quick.
That's all right. Go ahead.
I think that the problem with global warming and why you're seeing so much pushback against it is that there are these people that want to get at the billions of dollars of fracking gas and oil. Because I think around 10th grade science, it was a biology class, Miss Grace K. Vogel over at Forest Park, that taught us about the oxygen-carbon dioxide exchange, that plants take in the carbon dioxide that men or animals exhale and produce oxygen when so forth. So when you look at the greenery that's been destroyed, I mean, if you go look at the old, what's left of the Amazon rainforest in America here, northeast, northwest, what we've done to the grain areas, and then to want to add the denuding of the earth to the taste of frack, why can't we understand that the less grain, the less oxygen?
Mike Hidwell, I don't think you'll get an argument out of Mike or Daphne. Mike?
Well, there's certainly a lot of money to be made in the near term through fossil fuels, and that is really a big problem. And I think that the famous Mark Twain quote that you can't get someone to understand something if their paycheck depends on them not understanding it. There are a lot of people whose paychecks depend on the country not really coming to grips with climate change and doing something about it. But on the issue of fracking, I would say that if you want to learn more about it, there's a fracking battle right here in Maryland.
Yes.
November 12th in downtown Baltimore at MICA, there's going to be a whole conference on what to do about fracking and what the alternatives are, like wind and solar. So you can go to ChesapeakeClimate.org and learn more about that. Baltimore, November 12th at MICA.
And what we'll do is have you back on before that conference, Mike, and some others to get that moving, get people to join us for that conversation. We'll be doing that. And a very quick closing thought, Daphne, about just politically what you think where we go from here in terms of organizing and kind of really keeping the urgency high.
Well, I mean, I think the citizens of Baltimore can get involved. As I mentioned, the Baltimore Sustainability Commission is implementing a climate action plan. We need the support and involvement of people in developing that, in implementing that climate action plan. You can learn more at their website, which is baltimoresustainability.org. And you can learn more about the Genuine Progress Project, which we'll be using to evaluate that climate action plan at genuineprogress.net.
And we'll be putting all that on a website for both these things after the show, baltimoresustainability.org. I want to thank Daphne Weisham from the Institute for Policy Studies, Mike Tidwell, Chesapeake Climate Action Network, for joining us. Looking forward to talking to you all very soon in a continuing look at climate change and what we can do as citizens to stand up and make a new world. Mike and Daphne, thank you both so much.
Thanks, Mark.
Bye-bye.
We're going to take a brief break and welcome in Tyrone West's family to talk about what they've learned, what they've been doing. They've been demonstrating every week to stand up for his legacy and for the people of Baltimore. We'll hear their story. Stay with us. We'll be right back. And we are going to go out with Temptations, Just My Imagination.
Each day through my window, I watch her as she passes by. I say to myself, you're such a lucky guy to have a girl like her. Is truly a dream come true. Out of all the fellows in the world, she belongs to me. But it was just my imagination running away with me. It was just my imagination. Oh, yeah. A cozy